welcome to day 14 of the Everyday Novelist NaNoWriMo Ride-Along, or as we like to call it, the Nano Gangbang. With me today is Kitty.
Wee.
And Ben.
Hola.
And nobody else.
They all died.
So, we have it all. We can talk about them behind their backs.
Oh, yes. I've been dying to do that.
Let me get their check-ins out of the way first. Dee Dee has 1,000 words. They were actually from yesterday, but the text message didn't get through to me till today, so they count for today. And Tori has 150 words for today. Kitty, how are things for you?
I wrote 300 words of fiction.
Fantastic!
But they were not for this project.
Oh, well, that doesn't count.
No, it doesn't.
Alas, alas, alas and woe. Oh, well. Ben, how about you?
I bravely did indeed write some 250 words.
Oh, congratulations. Let's see. 200. I got my spreadsheet one day off, so that puts you at 1398. All right. And I got -2.
Negative.
I went through and did a lot of cleaning up the manuscript, which caused me to lose a lot of notes that were padding out the end of the manuscript. And then I wrote some, and it all came out to a balance of -2 words.
Ugh.
So, I suck. But, oh well. That happens sometimes.
You have more story now. It just doesn't seem like...
Yeah, that's true. So, I have more story and more detail. Yep.
Yes. The fear of having a negative word count is why I haven't cleaned up any of my manuscript, even though I wrote the beginning 3 times.
Do that at the end.
Yep. Doing that at the end.
It's been a very dumb day.
A dumb day?
Well, really, today what killed me was editing last night's episode. We went.
You're welcome.
Yeah, those of you listening at home didn't hear this, but we went for an hour and a half. And it's turned into the material that'll make up the back end of about like 4 or 5 episodes. But I had to go through all of it and decide what went into last night's episode, then edit last night's episode, then get the rest of it exported for future episodes. So it took about 3.5 hours.
And about an hour of that recording session was after I f***ed off to bed.
How long did last night's episode end up coming to?
The episode I dropped today, which was yesterday's episode, wound up coming in at like 8 minutes long. So for all that work. I mean, it happens sometimes, but oh boy. Demoralizing. But, and it's also cold enough out today that I couldn't take long walks. I had to climb. A lot of short ones, both to get exercise for myself and to keep this little fierce creature that's trying to play tug with me right now exercised. And she's still looking at me like, we haven't played much. But we go outside and she's like, it's cold!
Yeah. Yes, my day was a day of mostly cursing the cold as a pointless environmental pain in my ass that I have to deal with, even though I don't want to.
Just wait till the next ice age comes.
Let's not even talk about that. I'll be long dead. It'll be fine.
I had to deal with a cold day in the Midwest flatlands, which I didn't realize they were significantly different, but yeah, I had a Midwest wind chill, and yeah, there was a lot of wind chill. It was 27, which is about what it was when I left you guys, and I was like, 27, I can do fine with just a light jacket over a heavy sweater, right? And I'm like, what is this wind? It feels like 15. And of course I checked the weather and it was like 27 feels like 17. Like, at least my internal sense of temperature is accurate.
Yeah, people actually do die in the Midwest from wind chill all the time. It's just brutal, brutal out there. But now you can understand why Fargo was like Fargo was in the movie.
It has a certain psychological effect on you, just dealing with that cold. It sort of curbs the ego or something. We've now had a 13-degree night and I think like a 7-degree night since you left, Kitty. So good timing. It's only getting colder.
I'm beginning to wonder if this year is going to be like deep freeze with no snow. I've heard that happens up here from time to time. We seem to have nothing on topic to talk about, so we'll cut in one of the other night's episodes or discussions.
We had a couple sort of existentialist writer questions that we were kind of talking about before we came over and thought we should probably talk about them.
Yeah,
here too.
Yeah, let's go for it.
What was the first one?
One of them was writing to market versus writing for yourself.
Mm.
But also, I think it stemmed from something about enjoying writing. And if you want to be a proper writer, should you always enjoy it? And should it be this thing that it's just like makes you happy and lights up your life versus something that is sort of like a regular job that's frustrating from time to time, of course.
Yeah, we were kind of talking around that. And for me, I want to be a professional writer. Like, I know that. But it's been really interesting because I've come into this wanting to be a professional writer. But what it means to me is I want it to be like the perfect thing, the passion, the dream that I've always wanted to do, right? Like, you know, it's that thing that I've been told ever since I was a kid. Like, find your dream or your passion and pursue it and everything will be blissful.
Ugh, worst advice boomers ever gave us.
Well, it is terrible advice. And so what I've been discovering is I've been sorting through, like, you know, what part of that kind of fairy tale do I have to throw away to actually make writing work, right? And so that's been part of my mind games is like, oh, actually I have to treat it like work. And I've actually been modeling my writing, because I'll sit down and it's hard and challenging and I can't really deal with it because I'm expecting it to be fun and blissful on some level, you know? And so there's this big cognitive disconnect. And what I've been doing actually to try and get myself through that is I've been watching when I sit down to real work where it doesn't matter if I don't like it, I have to do it, you know, like we all do when we go to do our job that puts food on the table. And I've been kind of just mapping that and been like, oh, I deal with so much dissonance and frustration every single day when I approach that job. How can I bring that into my writing and not have the writing not be something I want to do because of that? So I don't know, that's just some of the stuff I've been thinking a lot about and really spending a lot of time thinking through and working through, because a lot of my energy has been just going out the window, sitting down and trying to write, and I can't write because it's not what I was supposed to be, you know, not what I...
One of my mentors saw that I was reading The Hero with a Thousand Faces back when I was first sort of getting familiar with Campbell and doing that instead of writing. There were a lot of the same stuff going on. It was like I wanted to write, but every time I wrote, it was crap, and, you know, I didn't have... Not everything I tried to show to people, they were like, I don't get it.
Man. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And it was... Yeah, it took a long time. It was frustrating. It was agonizing over every word and then hating myself for it.
Okay.
And this particular writing mentor said, ah, you're reading Joseph Campbell, huh? I said, yeah. He said, well, don't forget the most important part of that mythology cycle. And I said, what's that? He said, it's glorious to read about, but it's miserable to live.
Yes, yes.
Frodo and Sam didn't think they were on a glorious quest. They were just trying to get there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That helped me a lot. What I've found for myself is that there's this weird transition that happened for me between it's a trudge because it's complicated and I didn't know what I was doing. And, and then there's this brief window where, like, suddenly things started to click. It was about probably 200, 300,000 words in to my professional level stuff. And then after that, that phase for me passed relatively quickly, and it became like Heinlein describes it in The Cat Who Walks Through Walls as this addiction that if you don't service it, it starts to drive you mad and you become unpleasant to live with unless you get to the keyboard and write so that you can quiet all the shit that's going on in your head.
Yep.
And the process of slaking that addiction, some days it's frustrating, some days it's really glorious. The best days are the days when there's almost no experience at all. It just feels like, you know, you're in the story watching it happen, and then you discover that you've been writing.
Maybe it's just this whole thing with something that you feel is bigger than you, that you feel is amazing, because that's exactly how I feel with archaeology, that was my dream. And sometimes it's so frustrating that I just want to choke somebody out. It's so frustrating. You have paperwork, you have all of these things, you've gotten 3 hours of sleep, you're waking up at 4 a.m. It's a lot. But other times I have this bigger, it's like seeing the forest for the trees, but you don't always see it that way. Anyway, it's just one of those things where I think it's a similar experience. So yeah. Maybe I am approaching it a little bit differently because I know that I've gone after my dream, which is archaeology, thinking, oh my goodness, I'm going to go and it's jungles and like cool and Indiana Jones, and not quite. It's not quite like that. It's super tedious, super boring most of the time. But you have to really feel that underlying, like, why am I doing this? Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, for some reason, I love this and I love doing blah, blah, blah. And so I think that's the same thing with writing or anything that you're doing that requires love.
Yeah.
You know, you're not doing it for the money right away because you're not going to make money right away.
And anything that's a potent symbol to you, it's kind of like falling in love with a vampire, right? It's all glitz and glamour, and then they suck your blood.
Yeah.
Right?
Suck the life right out of you.
And like Hemingway said, writing isn't difficult. You just have to sit at a keyboard and bleed.
Yeah.
And
that's how I feel about archaeology, too. Yeah. You just got to bleed. You got to,
I mean, and you and I both know from running our own businesses, about 80% of running your own business is the fee that you pay for the freedom that comes with it. It's the admin and the taxes and the strategy. And it's all boring shit that has nothing to do with whatever business you're in.
Yeah.
It just has to be done in order to enable the business you're in.
Yeah.
Like doing all the groundwork before you build a house or something.
Yeah. I think part of what allows me to move forward is just getting in touch with that, let's say the comparative reality of pursuits, shall we say, right? So on one hand, I'll be doing a job, probably working for myself because I 6 months of any boss and I want to strangle them no matter how good of a human being they are.
That's like at all.
You know, so I kind of look at that. And then my perfect fantasy of writing is like, oh, I sit down full of inspiration with my coffee every day and I crank out 5,000 words without thinking about it.
And then you publish it and everybody buys
everybody
it
loves
immediately.
It. You know, and I never have to struggle and, you know, disc scratch on that. So then it's kind of like, well, all right, that's not accessible, boohoo. But what's the accepted norm in every other area of my life, no matter how much I hate it. You know, I was like, right? Like it's that 80% grinding work for 20% of doing something I actually enjoy. And so, and honestly, like that's been, I'll admit it, my fantasy fueled millennial soul. Like I don't really like to embrace that, you know, like I don't really like to let go of the fantasy that writing isn't going to be a beautiful fairy tale every day, but it's so worth it for me to do it. And I care about it so much that I will, right? It's like, well, whatever, like, you know, I can deal with this. I can.
It's like you went through, did a deep dive into Gilgamesh not too long ago.
Yeah, a couple years ago.
Gilgamesh's whole epic underneath. Gilgamesh isn't a hero because he goes on the adventure. Gilgamesh's suffering and adventures are what qualify him to be king. It's the process of that suffering that makes him into the king that he felt kind of like he was entitled to be.
Well, that's interesting. I hadn't really thought about it that way. I studied it, but I didn't really look at it full circle like that, but that makes sense. Interesting.
I'm just thinking, I haven't read the F.A. Gilgamesh in a long time. Archaeologist, I'm terrible. But he wasn't like this great person to begin with.
No, he wasn't.
He was kind of a real shit.
Yeah. So it's one of those things where it is the everyman's tale where I mean, it sort of speaks to the regular person who can do these things and can change. Yeah. And so I think, I mean, I never really thought of the Epic of Gilgamesh as particularly inspiring, but maybe that's just me.
Speaking of particularly inspiring, I read it a few years ago and then I read it again kind of sideways. I was looking up Ishtar or Inanna, which is the earliest Sumerian recorded mythology that we have. So I kind of came into Gilgamesh this time kind of sideways. And the story that really struck me, now that I'm 31 years old, I'm out of my 20s and I'm 30, but I definitely like feel my mortality at 30, where I just didn't most of my 20s. I didn't even think about it, you know, and then I've started to feel that. I think anybody who's lived sufficiently long enough gets that. But I read Gilgamesh, and the story that really stuck out to me wasn't the going off to slay Humbaba, you know, in the forest to get the timber. It was when Gilgamesh's friend died. And he was so distraught, you know, ruined by that, that he had to go on a quest across the sea to try and find a cure for death.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful, poignant story. And he finds the cure. And then as he's going back down to the sea, he drops the magical plant that will cure death. And he can't find it.
Oh.
And so then he has to come back, you know, after that. And just so like, it's just so tragic because he had it in his hand, you know, and he got it from the wise the wise man that knew about it, and then he dropped it and he had to come home empty-handed. Mm-hmm. But I love that because it's so, I mean, this is Gilgamesh, right? This is one of our oldest epics, and like that's so applicable to just the experience of like having a loved one die or however you come into your own understanding of your own mortality, and you're like, oh, actually there's a time limit on this, and actually this is something that's just part of being human, is the end of that. And
also caring for someone more than you care for yourself, because you're trying to, yeah, I think that is being selfless. It's putting yourself through all these trials for this other person as well, which is what I...
No, I'm saying carry on.
Yeah, no, I think that... No, I never really thought about it too much because we had to read it, and then I was like, blah, blah, blah.
You have to read is that way.
Yeah, yeah, like, especially if it's like...
It's the oldest epic, blah, blah, blah. Like, you know, now that you're saying that, there is some human truth to that, and it's also you have this sort of selfish person who through his journey is becoming like has these selfless deeds because he loves this other person so much.
Mm-hmm.
He's trying to find this plant or this flower or whatever. I can't remember exactly what it is. Mm-hmm. What you said,
he goes like a flower, I think,
or yeah, and to
that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that part of it, but yeah.
So there's this idea of selflessness, which comes with power. Mm-hmm. A lot of people describe, you know, you have all this power, blah, blah, blah. But if you want to be a true, powerful, wonderful person, you also have to be selfless, mm-hmm, and care for your people, but care for your loved ones. And no, I think that's great that you brought that up. I totally blocked that out of my memory.
Another one of the old, I can't remember who it was, but it might have been Walsingham, it might have been Machiavelli, but there's an old notion in European thought that a prince does not have his own life. He lives for his people.
Yeah. I think it's Machiavelli.
So. And this segues perfectly into another, the other thing we were talking about, which is writing something and hoping that it means something to your audience, right? And that's one of the things that I've been coming through in my writing is like, as I've been looking down and I've been seeing that it's not the perfect fantasy escape that I always wanted from pursuing writing is just not there. It's not on offer, right? I don't get that. I get real life just like everybody else, of course, right? But, you know, you got to come to terms with how you do. So kind of realizing that, I'm like, well, okay, what is here, right? And how can I approach this to make it worthwhile? And one of the things that Tori and I were kind of talking about was, well, part of what makes it meaningful is to write something that's meaningful to yourself and that you enjoy for sure. But it's really far more important and better is to have it be meaningful to somebody else. Because, like, mm-hmm, you know, it's like...
And a little being a little further down the road, those emails that you get from people for whom it's meaningful, they make it all worth it.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
I do sometimes.
Well, it's also... It's sort of this thing where I think what I, now that we've been talking about it, what I'm thinking of is if I can write for myself because I am a human being and I feel, then I want to be as true as I can to how I feel and the way that I think about things. And I know that other people connect with that because I'm human, they're mm-hmm human. That's just the way it's going to work. So I think versus trying to just write something that's amazing for somebody else that's beautiful and I think, well, you know, this group of people is really going to connect with it. If I can connect with it and I can create it from a real place, then mm-hmm I feel like it's just natural that likely people are going to connect with it.
Totally
because
agree.
I am human, I think. I mean, some other people don't agree.
At least by outward appearance.
At least this bodysuit that I have on is
Kitty,
human.
Are you and Tori from the same planet?
You know, if I can come at it 100% as me and from how I feel, then I think people will automatically connect with that. I hope so. Otherwise, maybe I am an alien. I don't know.
Well, no, depending on how weird you are, the subset of people that... No, Trixie, I wasn't calling you. Lay down.
She said weird. She's like, I'm down for that. I'm
the
weird
subset of people that any given piece will connect with can be larger or smaller, but there will always be someone. And yeah, it really is important to write for yourself. It's also important to write to somebody, and that really helps, especially once you get your basic bones out of the way. M.L. Buckman calls it your ideal reader. Sometimes it's a person. Like, my mission as a writer, my primary mission is to outfox Kitty. Because if I can outfox Kitty, I will surprise any audience. And if she's disappointed, it's not good. Because she's got this fantastic story instinct. But whether you have an actual person that you're writing to or you have a archetype of who you're speaking to as you write, that really helps focus your engagement. But like when you're writing a letter or when you're talking to someone, you are writing to them, but you're talking to them, but you are speaking and writing because there is something in yourself that you are trying to get out. And if you flip that around and you start writing for people, well, that's what professional ghostwriters do, and they tend not to have long careers because it burns them out really hardcore.
Interesting. That's a very helpful model there. Because I've figured out, I mean, I've been in marketing for as long as I could last, which is almost 10 years.
You know about the ghostwriter thing. So that's it for us here today. We'll be back with you tomorrow with hopefully some more great triumphs to report. And until then, have fun.
The Everyday Novelist is written by J. Daniel Sawyer and presented by J. Daniel Sawyer and Kitty Nakian and is produced by Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. The text is copyright 2019 J. Daniel Sawyer and the production is copyright 2019 Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license and all other rights are reserved to their respective owners.
Support this podcast and keep us going. Go to everydaynovelist.com/support to join up.